and welcome to Pedagodzilla, the pedagogic podcast with the pop culture core. Today, we are answering the bloody stupid question, what can vintage detective shows Columbo and Murder, She Wrote tell us about good intended learning outcomes? Answering that question, we have me. Hello, I am Mike Collins, your host as ever, a senior learning designer at the Open University, imposter syndrome incarnate, and a man with a tent bag of microphones that he's lugged across campus and probably left some marks on the walls with. And I am joined by today's guest.
Hello, I'm Tom Olney. I'm a senior manager for learning and teaching in STEM, also at the Open University, and can confirm that Mike has got a very big bag of microphones that he's lugged across campus, and it's right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a huge room, and the bag is taking up. We almost recorded in the podcasting booth, and that's the reason I switched it, because we would have been.
That sounds like a good plan, because yeah.
Yeah, we've been sitting on it. We are talking about, there's a couple of components to our question, Columbo, Murder, She Wrote, and learning outcomes. So let's break them apart in the first part of the show.
Part one, the question.
Part one. So, breaking apart our question, what can vintage detective shows Columbo and Murder, She Wrote tell us about good intended learning outcomes? Three bits to talk about there. Columbo, Murder, She Wrote, and learning outcomes. Let's start with the fun bit. Columbo and Murder, She Wrote. I mean, what a pair of meme fuel shows. What absolute joys they are. I end up watching a load of Murder, She Wrote at your recommendation at the was it Five on Demand or something?
Yeah, Five on Demand's got lots on there.
My god. Oh, so cozy, like a warm cardigan television.
Exactly that. Yeah,
absolutely lovely. So I mean, do you want to quickly like give us, I guess, the synopsis of what Murder, She Wrote is?
Well, I mean I love these shows, and I love like 70s 80s TV in general, really. I just think that they're especially the US stuff is just like a real part of a golden age of TV for me. And, you know, so I was born in the 70s and I was a teenager in the 80s. So I grew up like watching like shows like Moonlighting and Dynasty and Miami Vice and Murder, She Wrote. And they're all great, you know, and they remind me of when I was a childhood, but they're also kind of like a reminder of simpler times, I think, you know, like you say, like a warm blanket around you. But there's also that touch of glamour about them, you know, they're in the 80s and there's some great clothes and there's some great hair and there's lots of great stuff
and
in there too.
Great, like, personalities. I mean, Angela Lansbury, what a class act.
Exactly. That's
a, you know, the phrase classy dame was made just for Angela Lansbury.
Yeah, you're right there. I think those kind of shows got me into that kind of genre, if you like. And then a bit later on I got into some more gritty ones, maybe like Columbo and Hill Street Blues and Kojak as well, which I'm also a big fan of, and so which are more 70s kind of stuff, but they're a bit grittier and on the edge. So, but in general, yeah, I love that stuff.
So, I mean, the basic premise of the show for Murder, She Wrote, for I guess all three people in the world who've never really come across it.
Well, can we start with Columbo?
Yeah, are we going chronologically? Are we?
Because I think
Columbo was the 70s, Murder, She Wrote was the 80s.
Well, yeah, more or less. I mean, so Columbo's kind of got these two periods of when it was produced. So it started in the 70s, it had a whole load of seasons, ran all through the 70s. Then it took a break in the 80s, and then it came back in the 90s. There's like a total of 69 episodes of Columbo. And they're longer than the average one, but it's a terrific show. But and it's quite kind of, it's got this, you know, for people who don't know, which I'm not convinced there aren't many who don't. But let's,
I mean,
I think we have
PGC students who listen to this show, so there's probably people born who've never watched terrestrial TV on a Sunday afternoon.
Right. Oh well, they're missing out because. Yeah. Yeah, you want to get 5 USA on your satellite. Yeah.
So yeah, so Columbo, what's the kind of the slug, the synopsis of Columbo?
So Columbo is a detective. He's a he's works for the LAPD. He's a homicide detective, and the show is always set in California. I mean, that's one of the things. So it really reflects kind of California life, and it's really tied to that place, like some of these kind of shows are.
I mean, Columbo himself, he's kind of like a slovenly sort of, you know, he's a much, much parodied character. He's got this really kind of iconic sort of drawl to him in a couple of phrases. One more thing. Yeah, is it. This your knife? That's oh, it. Yeah, that is my. Oh, you got me. You got me. Like, you know, it's a real template for that kind of police procedural drama. But I'm probably getting ahead of myself somewhat with that.
Well, he's got. Yeah, I mean, he totally presents as like this kind of bumbling, inept kind of person with this like raincoat and stuff like that, and his cigar that's always hanging out of his mouth. And he always seems to be really out of place, because the suspects that he investigates are all really wealthy, and he drives this old car, this old banger. And they kind of invariably like underestimate him, and he lulls them into this false sense of security, and then they end up kind of incriminating themselves really in the end. But I think that's the interesting thing about Columbo, is that it's got this format, which is, it's very formulaic, but it starts, it's like a, in the genre, it's a how do you catch him?
Yeah, it's kind of like a flipped one, isn't it? They show you who done it at the beginning, and then it's how's Columbo gonna get them? How's he gonna nab them, trick them into incriminating themselves?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the smart thing about it, isn't it? He's so good at it, and he kind of does that by like kind of lulling them into this false sense of security that they've got away with it. And I think there's something in the show about them being wealthy and rich, you know, and thinking they're really smart. And he kind of always defers to them and says, oh, you know, I'm learning so much from you, you know, that kind of thing. It's great. I just love it. But I think the thing that's great about Columbo is everything's foreshadowed, you know, throughout the whole thing. And you know what's going to happen. But it's great to watch. It's just great TV.
It is great. It is genuinely great telly. All the greater telly digesting a massive roast dinner on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. Like it does seem perfect for that time slot, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It's like Channel 5 is basically, for me, police cops going up and down motorways, and then things like Columbo.
Yeah, there's some things that my mum likes a bit of Channel 5. She likes to watch the monkeys in there's a zoo show, I think. She's always going off.
Maybe we need to do an episode exclusively on Channel 5. It's the pedagogy of Channel 5. It feels like it'd be a really weird anthropological experiment.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, so... So that's Columbo.
Yeah.
Murder, She Wrote came a bit after. So Murder, She Wrote is the mid-80s to the early 90s.
Yep.
And is a more classic kind of whodunit format. Angela Lansbury plays Jessica?
Jessica Fletcher, J.B. Fletcher.
Who is a mystery novel writer. She teaches, and she's really switched on lady and really classy and really kind and just sort of generally nice and sort of a kind of is the American equivalent of Miss Marple.
Exactly that, yeah, like a respawn, really.
Yeah. And it operates in this wonderful sort of cozy, it's a fictional kind of American city that sort of somehow encompasses a sort of Americanery vibe. But again, the kind of the critical thing is that it's a very formulaic whodunit with, I think, a really interesting thing that it does with B-plots, which I think will probably tie into our discussion later.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what have I missed out about Murder, She Wrote?
So everything you said is absolutely right. So, yeah, she's this crime writer and amateur sleuth. But I think the thing about her that... So in a similar way to Columbo, she disarms people with her kind of... the way she presents herself, you know, it's like, oh, people don't take her seriously. The cops... in the show, never take her seriously.
Even though she's always the one who spots the bit of evidence.
Absolutely.
Cool.
And, you know, so the local cop will be like, no, it's not this random person that you're pointing the finger at. It's, you know, it's the obvious suspect, right? And then the show's based around her revealing that the cops need to do a better job but she's on the case and she'll do it.
Yeah.
But the thing I love about Murder, She Wrote is, or one of the things I love about it is she kind of it is set mostly in a fictional town, Cabot's Cove, which is supposed to be in Maine or somewhere like that, which is very Americana, hokey kind of place. But a lot of the episodes are set in other places. But J.B. Fletcher can go anywhere she likes.
Because she's a writer.
She's a writer, and then the show comes up with all these preposterous reasons for her to travel to New Orleans or New York or other places and instantly make friends with everybody that's there. I mean, everybody loves her, right? And she's so unassuming, and apart from when it comes to murder, of course.
Of course, but she's always inevitably on the case because nothing says somebody's about to die like her pitching up on the doorstep.
Yeah, exactly.
If you've got a years-old feud baking, now's the time to do the deed because she's just rocked up.
Yeah, that's right. So and then in this show, the suspects are really varied. Like, they're not quite as formulaic as Columbo. So I feel like, as well, Murder, She Wrote's a bit more fun, maybe. Do you know what I mean? There's a bit more lighthearted, but it's shorter too. It's only 45-minute episodes, so whereas Columbo's generally about an hour and a half, so they've got more time to build the characters a bit in Columbo.
Damn, that's really, wow. They'd never. It's really interesting that networks basically switched off hour and a half long shows, and they're sort of coming back through streaming.
Yeah.
So Columbo, the original like stream binge fuel.
Yeah, yeah. Just,
decades ahead of its time.
Yeah, yeah, you could say that. It is an interesting format, like, 'cause an hour and a half's quite a long time. It's like putting together a film, right?
Yeah.
Or what used to be covered for a film anyway. They're a bit longer these days, they seem to be.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. Oh, crikey. I feel like they need a toilet break in the middle of most movies now.
Yeah, exactly. I think hour and a half's about perfect, and yeah. Columbo kind of nails that pretty well.
Yeah.
Obviously, it stretches out to a couple of hours if you're watching it on Channel 5. But
so the things that you kind of unify this... yeah, the amount of adverts they're sticking, sorry. So the things that kind of unify both of these is that they are both, you know... to say formulaic, it can be used in a sort of... derogatory way, but they are formula-based shows, very successful, but there is an essential formula to them. They are, I don't want to call them the police procedural, but they are the crime drama procedural, of which, by the way, my two favorites are Castle and Lucifer.
Okay.
Castle, because it's just bizarre. It's a similar sort of thing as Murder, She Wrote. It's just, oh, it's a writer, so we can do anything we want.
Yeah.
And Lucifer, because it is a bizarre bastardization of one of my favorite comic book series ever by Mike Carey and Neil Gaiman. And they just took it in a completely different direction while at the same time making it quite fun.
Okay.
It's no connection whatsoever to the original property.
Right.
It's bizarre. It's what if Satan helped a lady solve crimes?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen Lucifer. I don't even know what it is.
Season one's a good watch.
Okay.
It's a little bit like, you know, Noddy and Winky knows itself, but it's good fun. It's good fun.
Okay, right.
Do you have any other like kind of crime procedurals in your what's the word, armoire?
I had to have a bit of time off work a few years ago, and I watched, they had Kojak on twice a day during the day on ITV4, and I watched it religiously. I watched pretty much 7 seasons of Kojak whilst I was recovering from an operation.
Oh my
goodness. Yeah, and that was I absolutely loved it. Kojak's great as well. Kojak's really good. But in a different way to these two. It's not as fun as these two.
Yeah, they are.
The thing that also ties them together in the formula or whatever is that they always win, right? They always get the murderer. The murderer is always found at the end. So you always get this satisfied, as a viewer, you're satisfied at the end. You know the good's been done.
Oh, that is a good tie back. Also, I'm just thinking about what that show would look like now, particularly Murder, She Wrote, if they just didn't find the murderer at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Just roll credits after 40 minutes. I would watch that show, actually.
It'd be great to find out what... it'd be great to find out how you would feel at the end of a show if the murderer got away, you know? Angela failed? No. Yeah. J.B. Fletcher can't fail. It's not done.
So that's Columbo and Murder, She Wrote.
Yep.
Let's talk about, in our question, we talk about good intended learning outcomes, but I think we need to talk about learning outcomes first. Now, we've talked about these in the show before, when we've talked about constructive alignment, and we've touched them on various other things as well, but we've never really dug into detail of what a learning outcome is, which if you're listening with your higher education hat on, is going to be, in fact, any education hat, because a lot of education now is outcomes-based, outcomes-led. Is going to be, you know, very relevant to you. So, what is a learning outcome other than an outcome of learning?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a statement, really. It's a statement about what the learner is going to be able to do by the end of the study. And that's really, in a nutshell, that's what it is. It's just a statement. It's directed at the learner. So it's directed at you, the learner. And it just describes what it is that you're going to be able to do by the end of your study. And the practice is to have that up front before you start, and then a bit later on as well. And the idea of them goes back to kind of like 1940s, really.
Crikey, I didn't really think about that far.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't called learning outcomes, but this idea of having some kind of intention, so laying out the educational intention early on in the piece is is very old, you know, well, as old as the 40s anyway. That's the first kind of references that I could find for it. And they've kind of gone through various name changes and stuff like that. There's this great quote, which I do want to just, this phrase, sorry, really, that's I think is an XOU person, actually, Derek Rowntree. And he wrote in 1982 that learning outcomes had become a minefield of terminological confusion. I just think it's a great phrase.
It's a great phrase.
Yeah, cracker.
I had another one today, which was a graveyard for good intentions. But that's the minefield of terminology is actually a great one, because a lot of the time people will conflate learning outcomes with other things which aren't learning outcomes. Like, you may have heard the phrase learning objectives, learning goals, learning aims. which are different. I mean, do you want to kind of unpick that a little bit, and what makes learning outcomes specifically learning outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important thing is that learning outcomes are student focused, right? So they're speaking directly to the learner, whereas aims and objectives and goals are generally what the teacher's going to be doing. So a bit more teacher focused. They're a bit more about what's in the module. What's the aim of the module, not about what the student's going to be able to do at the end. Mm. I think that's the core difference there, really. And but they do get, you know, those words that you've just said get mixed up with outcomes all the time. Mm. And I know in the US, objectives and outcomes are often transferable between the two words. But I think
pronounce aluminium wrong and crisps.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I spent too long in Australia. Sometimes I do call chips crisps, chips.
Oh dear.
My wife's Australian. She calls regular chips what we would call chips, hot chips. That's how they differentiate between them. I'll just leave you to think about that.
Yeah, man. Wow, I didn't think that would be the straw that broke my actual brain. I am now thinking of hot chips, though, so that's made me happy. Yeah, I'll just get some on the way home.
Hot chips and sauce. That's what what Aussies say.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, what are we talking about? Yeah, so I'm picking the terminology. But yeah, because there's, I mean, anybody who's been living in the UK recently will know how porous terms like goals and pledges are in various forms of discourse. Yeah, but a goal and an aim are often also associated with being a bit more aspirational as opposed to a target.
True.
Let's say an outcome is, by the end of this, you will be able to do this. If not, then either one of us has failed at our job.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really fair.
And an outcome is measurable. I mean, I guess I'm probably jumping ahead somewhat here, but...
Well, that is implicit in it too. Yeah, that's right. So, I think the thing is really just to kind of acknowledge that where we're at now, that there's lots of phrases that kind of go around, but to be really clear about what we're talking about as a learning outcome, it is this statement that starts a piece of learning off and finishes a piece of learning. And it takes a particular format, you know, like there is a recommended way that it should be constructed. And it should start with the sentence starter that's, you know, having completed this module or this course or this unit, you will be able to, and then have a verb, you know, that sets the cognitive level that the student will be able to demonstrate. And then the object, you know, the thing that the verb's going to act on. And then a qualifying phrase that kind of sets the boundaries really for how far and how long or how wide, you know, the object sits within the construct of the sentence, the statement. And, you know,
if I was to challenge you to on the fly, I could see a little bead of sweat forming. That's what I said. Come up with a learning outcome for somebody listening to this podcast and the level of understanding, for example, they might have about what a learning outcome is and how one can understand one through. And I'm conscious we're getting into knowledge and understanding territory here, which is...
Be careful, Mike. I think you've...
I know. I've just bumbled myself into a corner, but I'm going to stick with it. If you did have to off the cuff come up with one for this recording, what would it be that uses that formula you described?
Yeah, well, I think it would be at a basic level, right? So the verb would be at a basic level. It would be at a kind of understanding kind of level. So it might be something like describe or, you know, relate. I mean, I think what we're doing is taking something a bit further here. So... maybe a good verb would be relate, because what we're doing is we're setting up a premise here that we're going to relate good learning outcomes with TV detective shows from the 70s and 80s, right? So I think relate kind of works quite well in that phrase. So maybe it would be something like, having completed this module, this podcast, you'll be able to relate intended learning outcomes with, or good intended learning outcomes with, the TV shows Columbo and Murder, She Wrote, because we're limiting it to just those two shows. So I think that's a reasonable one to suggest.
Would you set a cognitive level of kind of like to a bloke in the pub or to a fellow pedagogue? Would that be a step too far? I mean, genuinely, because this is a question that comes up, I think.
Yeah.
I think people, we've had a conversation previously about how people sometimes misapply things like Bloom's taxonomy or Craftwell's taxonomy to add kind of an artificial sort of sliding scale of difficulty in there.
Well, I think if you change the verb, then yeah, like, so if you describe, then to somebody else would be, you'd need an audience, right, for that, unless you were going to do it in writing or whatever, but you need some kind of qualifier around that. But I think in relating it, you're not necessarily mixing it up with anybody else. You're just doing it for yourself. So probably in this first example, no. But if you wanted to change that to describe or communicate, something like that, I think it'd be fine. It's good. They're really flexible in that way, right? Mm. So depends. And obviously relating something's a bit harder, requires a bit more cognitive thinking.
Yeah, because it assumes that you're already able to describe it and now you're able to actually apply that description in a new context.
Exactly. And so if anybody's out there who can actually make sense of what we're talking about and follow it through to the end and then can describe it to a person in the pub, I'll be really happy with the hour or so I'm spending with you right today.
You'd be surprised. What else would you like to, is there anything else you want to sort of introduce at this point when we're discussing learning outcomes? I mean, I think we mentioned as well that a good, well-designed learning outcome should be measurable. The outcome in itself should be measurable, so it should be inherently, to a degree, accessible in an education context.
I mean, you hinted at it before, and I know you've talked about this on the show before, but constructive alignment is, you know, learning outcomes are really fundamental to that those three elements that are in there. So I think it's worth just reminding us, you mentioned assessment, that there's a relationship between learning outcomes and activities and assessment. It's really important. And, you know, learning outcomes really have to kind of, you know, define what the activities are, and the activities really have to like be linked into the incorporate the assessment into them. And then the assessment really is the vehicle by which you, you know, demonstrate the achievement of those learning outcomes. So they're all linked together, and it's really important that they are. Yeah. So the way that they're described is really important because if you start with them, which is a good way to do it, I think.
Well, I think it's the established way with a lot of instructional design models. And from my own design experience, it's the best way to start a design. You start with your vision, your top level vision. You then create your learning outcomes, which is a combination of your vision, your learning intent, and also, to be honest, all of your understanding about who your learners are, your kind of, you know, your goals for actually the module, you know, what the marketing team are saying you need to be doing, that kind of thing, because heaven forfend, it should be fun. Yeah. But, you know, but it's where you're, it's the place where you're speccing out the actual detail of what you're going to teach. And I mean, something I guess we've not really touched on so far is that we've talked about how you might use it for a piece of learning, but that piece of learning could be an entire program. It could be a qualification. It could be a unit, a module, a week's worth of learning. It could be an hour or just a 10-minute session. It's an incredibly flexible tool that you can apply at multi-levels. And then, of course, as a design tool, that can propagate downwards. So you design at the top level, you design at your program or qualification level. That then gives you your, okay, so to get to X point, my qualification endpoint for these learning outcomes, my graduate outcomes, I then need to have at level one, step one, as we were talking about earlier with the level of cognitive demand in the verbs, and then step two, step three, level one, level two, level three. And then within those levels, you're able to then break that down and go, okay, so how are we scaling from naught to whatever our learning outcome endpoint is with that? And then it may well be that you're kind of breadcrumbing that throughout, making some big hand gestures, which podcast listeners are not going to see. You might hear a whiff of air. You're breadcrumbing that upwards with sort of, you know, smaller breakdowns of that throughout your learning, depending on its length. So as a tool, it's not just something you use in the lesson. It's something that is kind of intrinsic to how you develop, period. And it's why I think we're talking about this as its own specific item outside of constructive alignment, because it is very much that starting point for intentional design. And it's also the point where you can really screw things up or get things really right, because there's nothing worse than getting halfway through and realizing that what you've written doesn't align with your learning outcomes, or actually they were bad in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really important point too. So, and I think there's a challenge here. So it depends on your circumstances, right? But it might be that you're, I'll talk a bit about this in a minute, but if you're, it may be that your learning outcomes are already decided for you. You know, you're still designing learning, but you've somebody else, you know, an educational board or a university or whatever, has already prescribed what the learning outcomes are going to be for the piece of learning that you've got to design. And it might be that you just have to work to them, and sometimes they're not very good. You know, and that makes your job much harder. If the learning outcomes are the intended learning outcomes are well written, then it really helps you to design something good around them. And I've got an example that I can talk to a bit later on about maybe how that works.
Do we need to change the names or anything? Do we need to?
No, it's a long time ago. No, and these are good ones. I've got some bad ones as well near the end.
Oh, lovely. That'll be the patron have... exclusive for when we eventually set up a patron program.
which I will have to change the names for.
So I think that covers kind of both the good and intended side of things. Is there anything else you want to talk about with regards to learning outcomes? Well, do you want to talk about sort of structure a little bit? And
Well, what I was going to say is, so this idea of the word intended, I think is worth picking up as well, just because, you know, I think it's fair to acknowledge that learning is not always what the teacher intends it to be, right? And so there are unintended learning outcomes, and they're fine, just got to acknowledge them. But, you know, by definition, you can't describe what an unintended learning outcome is before the module starts, so, or before the piece of learning starts. So it's worth just, you know, having that clarifier there, I think, that the word intended does help in a lot of conversations, especially in higher education, because there's probably more unintended learning outcomes that come out of learning. It's worth acknowledging that they exist, and that's fine, but that's not your job necessarily as a teacher to prescribe those beforehand, because how could you? They're unintended.
Oh, that's such an, that's a really interesting one. We talked about years ago now, Critical Digital Pedagogy, Jesse Stommel's work.
Right.
And yeah, I think indirectly it sort of talks about unconscious. It's how sort of your own sort of assumptions and biases and just the context essentially,
yeah,
to a degree does actually influence your teaching and the impact it has on students.
Yeah.
And encourages people to kind of to look at that critically. So yeah, we're 25 minutes into the recording now. I've not actually said why I asked Tom to come and talk about learning outcomes.
Yes.
To your ears, Tom was just hanging out at a bus stop, but I grabbed him and he's just started talking wonderfully about learning outcomes.
I think we wanted to get into the Columbo, right?
We're just so keen.
Yeah, I just want to tell everybody about Columbo and get them watching it. And Murder, She Wrote, to be fair.
Yeah, I was really, really enjoying it. Well. So Tom, why have I dragged you off the street to talk about learning outcomes?
I'm working here with you at the moment, but I'm a senior, so my title is a senior manager for learning and teaching, and I work in the Faculty of STEM. And at the Open University, thank you. And so some of my responsibility in that job is about learning design. And I started at the OU nearly 10 years ago now, and my way into the university was around learning analytics and learning design. And I've kind of always been interested in that area, that kind of curriculum design stuff. And the way that the kind of timeline worked was I worked in the learning design project, which is an institutional project that kind of set up some of the ideas around learning design. And then at the same time that project, findings from that project went into BAU, then it's into business as usual. Then I moved roles into STEM and went about the task of kind of embedding it into STEM, or embedding things around learning design into STEM. So that's what I've kind of been doing, as at least a part of my role, for the last few years. And once some of those things were kind of started to get embedded, the things that were very different about learning design, I suppose, then I started to realise as well that the practice of learning outcomes was very different, very varied, and didn't really match up with my experience of using learning outcomes in my previous role, which was as a teacher. So I was a secondary school teacher before I became before I started working at the OU, and spent a lot of time using learning outcomes to design my own kind of courses and my teaching practice. I did that for 10 years. So that's kind of what I bring to it. And I wanted to kind of, so, you know, in that teaching role when I was a teacher, I used to work in Australia, and I was a Victorian teacher, and so that's got its connotations obviously in England. And I'm not talking about, you know, students with blackboards and stuff
like Victoria.
That. Yeah.
Right. That took me longer than it should have to unpack. Yeah. There we go.
But yeah, I mean, some of the things I'll say now are like, they come with the prefix Victorian, and I'm not talking about the 1850s. I'm talking about the practice in Victoria, and it now appears to me quite clear to me that in Australia they're quite far ahead, or seem to be quite far ahead of the UK in terms of using learning outcomes.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. We had some visitors from one of the open universities of Australia. I want to say Auckland, a couple of years ago.
Well, that's in New Zealand, Mike. But
okay. In which case, I'm miles off. We definitely had some visitors from Australia
right, okay.
A few years ago. And I just remember that they had a government mandate around good learning design. They had to be able to evidence good learning design.
Right, okay.
As part of the institution's ability to be self-crediting, which I thought was really interesting. because they were, you know, they were sort of sharing their learning design practice, and we were talking about ours, and it was just, and they were talking essentially about how the design spec had actually become kind of, you know, a spec for design, which I know anybody who's involved in learning design and design specs will know that, will be just a single tear rolling down the side of their eyes at the moment. I thought was really kind of forward looking, because it's sort of shows that there's a commitment to making sure there's actual a robust approach. Because I mean, I don't know anybody who's had a face to face university experience in the UK will know that it can be a little bit of a crapshoot sometimes. Yeah. I think back to my own time at university, and while I very much enjoyed it, I would have struggled to have told you what the learning outcomes were for a lot of the modules I was studying. I would really have struggled to tell you what my favourite ones had to do with the learning outcomes and assessment. For example, my wonderful lecturer who spent like a month talking to us about his in-depth research about iconography around the sands of Iwo Jima. Right. And then you go, how does this relate to this thing on production? Mm-hmm. You go, and what's the essay about now that we're doing at the end of this? Sorry, I've gone into the long grass. It's getting dark.
I think, you know, when the education board, Victorian Education Board, bought in they called them the Victorian Essential Learning Standards at the time, VELS. So if there's any people in Victoria listening to this, they might inwardly groan. But as a new teacher, for me, I found them enormously helpful, because they told me exactly what I was supposed to be teaching. And they told me what the students were going to have to be able to do by the end of the module, because they were kind of couched in learning outcomes. So not being a super experienced teacher, that was really great for me. And it gave me an enormous sense of satisfaction and well-being to know that what I was doing was actually what I was being told to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm able to avoid that very thing that you're talking about, Mike. And I was the head of humanities in the school, in one of the schools that I worked at. And that was a school that needed a lot of work helping with its curriculum, particularly in the humanities department. So I spent a good few years trying to wrestle that curriculum into a shape that was that could be measured by the learning outcomes that the education board was setting, and that we were on the right path, we were doing the right things, because practice had grown up where it was just people doing things that interested them and teaching kids about stuff that interested them in history, for example, or geography or whatever. And that's not right. That's not the way it should be.
There is a separate discussion to have had at some point about constructive alignment, reductivism, and still like papering on the love of a subject, but that's a different discussion for a different day. Because at the moment we're talking about learning outcomes. It's a design tool. It's the bones. It's the design tool, the bones, and the intent.
Yeah.
Should we move on and perhaps bring our components together? By the way, this is that CV you just heard is why Tom has got the unenviable go to for a lot of my team for any time that learning outcomes come up. We're like, we'll speak to Tom. Literally, like, imagine your eyes just rolling in the back of your head every time you see one of us come up in the subject line. Tom, can we talk about learning outcomes? So we have talked about Columbo, we have talked about Murder, She Wrote, and we have talked about good and intended learning outcomes. Let's bring them together now as we answer our question in the next part of the show. What can vintage detective shows Columbo and Murder, She Wrote tell us about good intended learning outcomes?
Part two, the answer.
Okay, Tom, hit me. Is it that they're all just really good?
Well, I think they can tell us some things, right? But not, obviously not everything. But I think one of the things that's really sprung to mind is this idea in Columbo that everything's foreshadowed. You know, so you know the outcome before you start, and that really represents what a good learning outcome
is. I wondered where you were going to go with that.
See what I did there?
Yeah, okay. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So, you know that Columbo's going to get to the end. You know what's going to happen in the end. And Columbo's going to get the consistent outcome. He's going to find the killer. But as a viewer, as the learner, you know that already. You know who the killer is. So it's not about finding out who the killer is. It's about finding out how to get there.
That's such a good analogy. It's about the jet. Oh, I like that.
And to get there, obviously, there's activities, right? In a learning journey, there's all these activities that kind of build you up and allow you to demonstrate the learning outcome by the end of it. And for Columbo, he's got a whole set of activities that he goes about, and he mixes it up. Sometimes he does certain things. He shuffles around in his pockets looking for and asks for a pencil to disarm people. Or he gets his cigar and asks for an ashtray so that he can move topic onto something different. Or he talks about his wife, you know, who's this mystery person in the show. and I think that, you know, let's draw the analogy between those and different types of pedagogies that you can use to get your students from the learning out, from to the educational aim.
The dead body.
Yeah, to the outcome at the end. And you can pick and choose from those. And there's nothing, learning outcomes are not saying to you, you must use this pedagogy, you must use flipped learning, or you must use collaborative learning, or any of them. It's just saying, all you got to do is move these students from A to B. And along the way, you do the things that you think are best for them. And if you want to build some skills in there as well at the same time, then brilliant. Use some pedagogies that reflect those skills. That's how I think about them.
That's such a nice analogy. And I'm particularly liking actually the Columbo model now, because that's a really good example of transparent pedagogy.
Exactly.
So that's the students having a good idea of what a learning outcome is. So essentially, students going in actually understanding what it is you're trying to teach them from the off, which I know sounds like a real ground floor day one bit of teaching, and yet one that's often missed.
Probably the most important lesson you'll have.
Yeah, it's what are we actually going to do? What are we hoping that you pull out of this? Essentially, what are we cueing
not
your...
hoping.
Oh, sorry. What will you?
Yeah.
And I mean, from a cognitive perspective, that is cue. You're trying to cue the learner's brain up to connect, you know, what they're doing to this outcome that you've set at the beginning. And then, of course, by the end, this is the end point. This is what you'll achieve. And we will know you have, because it is an assessable outcome.
And we will know Columbo's found his person because they will be arrested or they will confess,
and the Simpsons is on afterwards.
Exactly. And we'll know because Columbo will turn away from the camera, and those yellow kind of text that comes up in all those 80s shows will just come up on the screen. It'll just be like, oh, that was so satisfying, I love that. And that's how your students should feel, right? Completely satisfied, they understand, they're totally clear to them, yes, I've completed this course because I've demonstrated that learning outcome and I've therefore passed.
I think you're making a really strong case for all of our modules to end on A, rolling credits, but B, kind of like slap bass and a saxophone.
I wish they could have that yellow lettering that's synonymous with those shows. I just love it.
Oh, yeah.
Why did they choose yellow and in the 3D kind of thing? But it's across all of them.
Oh,
it's great.
Oh, I think I know the reason for this, but it's incredibly boring.
Maybe you did tell me.
I'll tell you another time if you need to go to sleep some point. Or...
Well, I would find that very interesting. I mean, maybe the listeners.
Bruce saw a really good YouTube video. Basically, there was this machine.
Oh, right.
Because it was before it all had to be like hand done, but there was this machine that basically printed it. You could print it onto film.
Oh.
So it was like early, like really early computer graphics. It was you had a load of TV stations or had those like really bad like 3D kind of model things in their intros.
Right.
And it was just like this one machine that one type of machine that just made loads of them. They were super ubiquitous. Anyway, sorry. Unbelievably off topic.
Okay.
Let's go back to foreshadowing is not the only reason. I mean, I've got my personal theory on B plots. In fact, I'm gonna throw it in. This is kind of like
Where does she write now?
I'll go Murder, She Wrote, yeah, because I think Murder, She Wrote does this really beautifully, and that Murder, She Wrote has, again, very well-established format, you know, it's actually normally, a bit of light relief, starts to introduce the B-plot, it's like, oh, look at Billy Scuggins, isn't he a rot of that? She's got a heart of gold, and they're best of pals, they get on really well, but then, the crime, the A-plot, and then there's the investigation, meanwhile, Billy Scuggins is, he's knocking over bikes or something, or doing whatever he does, but the B plots and the A plots will always collide and come back together at the end, no matter how separate it appeared they were. I'm not necessarily saying that introducing a B plot piece of learning where you go, "What the hell are you talking to me about this?" It's bad. But what I am saying is that there is a wonderful thing in basically having no wasted meat on the bone. Every bit of what you're using in an education context essentially being useful in achieving the outcome. Obviously, you know, having the disconnected Billy Scuggins, I personally kind of like a little bit of a surprise myself. I know it's actually really terrible design, but like, for example, queuing up a bloody stupid question on how does. And then suddenly going like, well, actually, the Columbo model is you didn't know that you were going to get the Columbo model of design out of this, but afterwards you'll be like, just one more thing. We should use the Columbo model. But yeah, sorry, that's my theory of B-plots.
Well, I like it. I never thought about that before, actually. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. you don't want to be wasting any time in the classroom, do you? Or in your module design if it's online.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And I feel like it's also the place where, because I talked before about reductivism, it's probably the place where you get your love of the subject in. It's the place where you go, hey, this is the bit. I know we're doing this this module on, let's say, particle lasers, the high impact particle laser. But actually, let's just talk about tangerines for a while and why tangerines are great. And then you go, guess what happens when you throw a tangerine into a particle laser? Fun.
Sure.
And then suddenly you bring that. This is actually a terrible idea. If you are designing a course on lasers or tangerines, please don't
course
cite
on
this.
Tangerines. I'd like to know what that is.
I feel like there must be. McDonald's have a burger university, don't they? Yeah. In the States. So there must be somebody doing a tangerine.
Yeah.
Probably. Wow.
I always like Satsumas better than tangerines.
The one of the boxes you get at Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, devil fillets.
There's something very satisfying about saying Satsumas.
Easy peel Jaffas aside. What else we got about, connecting Columbo Murder, She Wrote and good intended learning outcomes? What can they tell us?
Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about in Murder, She Wrote is this, the way that Jessica Fletcher moves between different places. And she's always really welcomed in those different places. She makes friends with everybody. And it just shows this kind of transferability of her and her skills. She can move between these different contexts, and she can integrate with different people at all different levels of society. So like Columbo's a bit tied to being the kind of rough detective, if you like, that's out to get the rich and famous members of the high society in California. But J.B. Fletcher is totally different. She'll move around with everybody. And so she just slightly adjusts her way of thinking and slightly adjusts her persona to kind of make sure that she fits in wherever she is. And I think, you know, good learning outcomes do a similar thing, right? You just need to slightly adjust them. You need to think about the cognitive level and adjust it. You need to think about the qualifying phrases that you're going to use, and you need to adjust them so that they fit in with the context of where you are. You liking that one?
I am. It's just the mental image of Angela Lansbury just sort of sliding into the top of your module. We're like, oh, hello there, dear. It's just something. There's something really quite comforting about the image. I don't know why.
I mean, she's a master at it, isn't she?
Yeah, she really is. Yeah. But I know, I see exactly what you mean, because it's about, again, it's about seeing it as a tool. I think one of the issues with learning outcomes based design sometimes, particularly when it's misapplied or kind of institutionalized, is it becomes part of process. And when something becomes part of process, people stop using their brains. They start going, okay, so I've got to do this thing, I've got to fill out this form, I've got to use this structure, and they stop using it for its intended purpose, which is as a tool that helps you. It shows up at your family gathering in New Orleans where the jazz singer's just been knocked off by his evil ex-brother or something.
Did you watch that same episode?
Same episode. I really enjoyed it. I guess this is one of my big things to watch out for as well, is that it's where it's not used in a smart kind of sociable way, where it's not actually where it's not fit to context. It can be a really not to say dangerous tool, but it can just lead you in the wrong direction.
Clumsy.
I mean, I for example, if you have a preset framework of learning outcomes that you have to adhere to, no names, which can, you know, hinder you or just make people feel that they have to kind of go down blind alleys. And then if you are using learning outcomes based design, which is a good thing, but using it with duff learning outcomes, which is a not good thing, then suddenly you find yourself having to pepper in all sorts of weird bits and bobs and dross, which aren't particularly relevant to what you're trying to teach.
No, I couldn't agree more. And so I think Murder, She Wrote can kind of tell us a little bit about that, you know, that you want to fit to the context, and you want to be like J.B. Fletcher, you know, who gets propositioned from literally every man that she ever meets of a certain age. You can spot them right from the start.
But
they're
can't you? The slick back hair, isn't it? Every time.
You know, you can just see them almost salivating at the prospect of, you know, becoming good friends with J.B. Fletcher.
Some wonderful mental imagery today. I don't know if it's the lack of sleep that's just causing these visions to appear, or if we've run out of oxygen in this quite small room.
There is a danger with Murder, She Wrote, I think. It's not what you said before, but it kind of linked to it a little bit, I think, is about this idea of throwing red herrings in. You know, like writers like to do that, to send you off on a bit of a different tangent, right, as a viewer, to kind of obfuscate the thing.
That is interesting.
You don't want to be doing that. I would say that that is bad.
And that's probably where the Columbo and Murder, She Wrote distinction comes in, because Columbo, you've got a much clearer path made to be, whereas Murder, She Wrote, it is very much, it does try to, it's much like any crime procedural, it's trying to keep the viewer guessing and lead them off on, like, the first person who's up in front of the police, he did definitely not do it.
Yeah.
The guy with blood over his hands and the knife saying, it was me, I did it, didn't do it, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really got no place in learning that I can see, or in good design that I can see. It's just, you know, there's no point. Why would you try and confuse your learners, right? You keep it simple.
Yeah. We confuse them enough as it is. Intentionally. Yeah, with our best intentions, we confuse them.
That's right, exactly. I've got a massively tenuous one. Do you want to hear it?
Oh, especially if it's really tenuous. In fact, the more tenuous, the better.
So I don't know if you... this is even better because you watched the same episode that I'm going to refer to now. So in that episode when she's in New Orleans, see if you can remember the plot twist at the end, or the piece of evidence that sends the killer to jail is the fact that he's got a ring not dissimilar to mine with a square thing on it, and the victim has got a square indentation on their neck where they were strangled. And Jessica Fletcher notices that the killer is wearing this particular kind of ring. It's a square garnet ring that he passed down from his daddy. And that's the bit of evidence, right, that nails him in the end. And in a different episode, and an episode of Columbo I watched the other day, you know, the murderer shoots the victim in the head, the body slumps down onto the table, and then the killer goes around and cleans up the room and then places the gun that he used in the killer's hand, and then it falls onto the floor. But as soon as Columbo comes into the room, he notices that underneath the gun is some drops of blood, and so immediately he's like, well, how did the blood get there before the gun fell on the floor? Because surely the gun would have fallen before it got shot. So my point is, which I'm getting to, right, that Jessica Fletcher and Columbo are very observant. And it is really important, here's a tenuous link, that your learning outcomes are observable.
Oh, crikey, righty. That was a long walk around the park. Oh, I like it. Okay, do you want to dig into observable a little bit?
Yeah, so, I mean, you've got to be able to measure them, right? That's the important thing. You've got to be able to find a way that the students have got to demonstrate that they can do this thing that you've set up for them to do. And so it needs to be measurable, because in all likelihood you'll be assigning grades or some kind of level to them. So you want to be able to measure it. And you want to be able to measure it in a way that's also got some opportunity for the students to demonstrate different levels of ability of doing these things. And it needs to be observable, because you need to find that evidence. You know, as a teacher, you need to be able to really point to that evidence and say, yes, I'm confident that the student can pass this course because they can demonstrate this learning outcome, and here's my evidence to prove it. So when you're setting up the activities or the assessment, you know, that there has to be in there, there has to be a very clear bit of evidence to that's observable and measurable.
And I think that's one of the hardest aspects of actually designing a good learning. I mean, there's kind of... I'm probably slightly out of the loop with this and the contemporary reading for various reasons, but there is a bit of a discussion happening generally around, for example, knowledge and understanding style learning outcomes, because it's quite hard to measure. You can measure people being able to demonstrate their understanding by describing or by relating, as we discussed earlier. But it is quite it's a tricky one. It basically draws you back to the question of what is understanding? And you go, oh God, do we talk to a neurobiologist? Do we talk to a constructivist? Where's Vygotsky? Dig Vygotsky up. So actually kind of there's a real challenge early on in actually making it accessible. And it's why more often than not, you'll see a lot of instructional design models go, design your learning outcomes, then design your assessment. Or realistically, if you've designed your learning outcomes really well, you've kind of actually already designed your assessment. You just don't even know it yet, because you've already used all of the key skills and verbiage in there that kind of describes, and then you're just looking at modes. But that's a different episode for a different time. Modes of assessment, don't have time for it now.
I mean, you definitely should not be writing learning outcomes that are based around knowledge and understanding. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It is bad, bad practice. And the really easy way to get around that is, there's nothing wrong with having a list of content or content, you've got to have content, right? But just provide it in a list and say, and the way that the, to go back to the Australian study designs that I used as a teacher for the VCE subjects, I used to teach international relations, politics. And the way that they did it in that study design was really great. They had the learning outcome. And then they said, in order to achieve this learning outcome, you will draw on the following knowledge.
Oh, I like that.
And there's just a list of the things that you need to know. The things that, as a teacher, you need to teach the students about these things. And by understanding those things, they will be able to demonstrate the learning outcome. It's really simple. It's really elegant. It works really well. There's also some information about skills that you need to develop. But they're not presented as learning outcomes because they're a different thing. It's not hard.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. I've been like wrestling with this. Like, well, what would you do instead of? And Tom's just like, yeah, slap that one down.
Yeah,
that's wonderful. Can we use that going forward?
You know, Mike, let's hope we can, because this model, and I've got the little example here. It's worth just spending 5 minutes if that's all right.
Yeah, for it. Hit me.
So, in this study design, this area of study was called power in the Asia Pacific that I used to teach. Okay, so this is about, you know, how power is exerted in the Asia Pacific region. And you've got a choice of different Asian Pacific states that you can look at their foreign policy. It's basically what the course was about. It's 40 hours worth of study plus some homework. And you can choose from Australia or Indonesia or Japan or the US or China. And I always used to do China option. So, but the outcome is the same for whichever one it is, whichever, it doesn't matter which country you do, because the learning outcome is, on completion of this unit, you'll be able to analyze and evaluate, there's your verbs, two, not the best, but it's okay, we'll get around with that. Analyze and evaluate the effectiveness of the use of various types of power, that's your object, by a specific Asia Pacific state in pursuit of its national interests, there's your qualifying phrase, it's limited to a particular state and the way that they do their national interests, right? And then you've got the sentence, to achieve this outcome, the student draws on key knowledge. And that key knowledge includes, for the politics people out there, things like key terms, sovereignty, national interests, power, security, idealism, pragmatism, for example. And then a bunch of other things about the about what national interests are. You know, you've got to define them. What are the national interests of China, for example? Different types of power, hard, soft, military, those kind of things. And anyway, by you look at those, that list of knowledge, you teach that knowledge, and then by the end of it, the students can analyze and evaluate. If they can do it, they need to be able to analyze and evaluate. So they need to compare and make a judgment about which ones are most effective, which types of exercising power in which context is most effective, what are the outcomes of that, and justify why they think that. And that one learning outcome drives that 40 hours of study. That drives the whole thing. And as a teacher, I get that learning outcome and that list of knowledge, and that's it. The rest of it, I build all the activities. I've got freedom over the assessment. And I kind of design that. You know, it's a humanities course. It's got a bit, you've got to write an essay. But there's also opportunities to do a bit of project work and different kind of things, do a presentation, you know, mix it up a little bit in there, do some collaborative learning around this part of it, you know, blah, blah, however you like, really. Do some investigation yourself. Boom, you're away.
Simple.
It's not that hard. You know, honestly, it's not that hard. We wrap ourselves in knots. It's not that hard.
Is that? Oh, man, I feel like we need to draw this bit into the tips, because I feel like there's a tip bubbling out of here.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, well, let's...
Yeah. Tom's just produced like 6 pages of tips.
There's lots of tips. Do you want to move on to the tips?
I tell you what, I want to move on to the tips, but I want to quickly summarize.
Okay.
So we've talked about, we have answered our question there, I think, pretty comprehensively.
Yes. Well, the only thing I would say to add to it is that, I suppose to wrap it up, if you like, is what I was just saying. You know, it's not that hard. And there's a reason why Murder, She Wrote and Columbo ran for so long, because they found a format and it works. And they just stuck to it. And, you know, the Bologna process is 10 years in the making of the European Union coming together and saying, let's use learning outcomes, you know, as the basis for standards and stuff and transferable program levels and standards across the union. And here's how we'll do it. And if you just refer to the Bologna process, I mean, it's clever people spent a long time doing that. You don't need to mix it up very much. It's there for you to use. And I just think we tie ourselves in knots. But, you know, Murder, She Wrote, Columbo, they ran for a long time. They stuck to their formula. If we stick to this stuff, it's, you know, we'll be fine. You know, it will.
There's an actual pain in the corner of Tom's eyes here where he's like, it's easy. It works. Why do people make this look so hard sometimes?
Keep it simple. You know, those shows keep it simple, right? They stick to the format. They keep it simple. And I suppose it is worth saying there's always a question about number of learning outcomes.
Well, let's draw that into the tips then.
Okay.
So let's pull all of this together, everything we've talked about so far, everything we've learned, and Tom's decades of experience into the final part of the show where we should get some tips about how you can apply this in your own practice.
Part 3. Practical tips.
Tom, hit me. Move them tips. I mean, apart from the one which you just ended, the thought you just ended on, which is, it's simple, where you basically kind of grabbed the listener by the shoulders and shook them. It's simple.
I mean, I think the hardest thing about learning outcomes is actually writing them. If you've already given them, designing a course around them is good. You know, that's the easy bit. Well, not the easy bit, but that's the satisfying bit, and that's the straightforward bit that is very simple. Writing them is a little bit different because you've got to filter out the noise a bit, and you've got to make sure you focus in on what you do. But if you do it properly and take your time over it, it's not that hard.
The structure and the intent is simple. It's the not simple bit is essentially applying it to your teaching context. Yeah. It's where we go, okay, how do I pull apart this section of qualification or thing? What am I trying to do? It's where you're drawing together all the complexity. It's we talked about liberating structures and freedom within a framework previously. It's where you give structure to that. And that will probably be quite a complex process.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess my thing here would be, ye gods, put some proper time aside for it. Don't just make it 20 minutes in a workshop. Exactly. That won't be long enough. Set aside days because it is worth getting them right early because you'll wish you had otherwise.
So when I'm working with teams here at the OU, the way that I've come to do it over time is not assume that it's going to be quick and easy. And one top tip, if you're in a position like me or you're actually working with module teams, is put in the pre-work. So sit down with a couple of people, the key people on the module team, long before you get into a workshop scenario, and to have some back and forth. You know, go through 3, 4, 5 drafts to get to a point where you're relatively happy with what you think. It looks okay. And then take them into a workshop situation where you've got maybe 20 people however many engaged in the module and refine them, you know, crack into them and really give them a really critical view. And then spend, an hour, hour and a half on them. And then you should come out with something that's workable. But if you don't put the pre-work in, You can't take them to a big bunch of people and say, like, let's work something up here. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So you've got to go. And, you know, my advice is, you know, somewhere between 8 and 10 is a good landing point.
Yeah. I mean, for a particular size. So we were saying, for example, is that for a 60 credit higher education module or what would be your kind of?
Well, I've just been reading the advice around this I don't necessarily think that the size of the module is necessarily that relevant to the learning outcome number.
Is it about diversity of what you're teaching?
It's about the quality of the learning outcomes. It's about the cognitive levels that you set them at. I think the discerning factor is how manageable are they for a student to read? That's the important thing.
Yeah, I guess that was one of the things we haven't really touched on so far, but it's one that's really, really, really easy to screw up because it's not just a tool for you to design with. It's also, this is your statement of intent.
Yeah.
This is your pitch to your students.
Yeah.
By the end, you will be doing blur.
Yeah. So you got to think like, well, what's manageable for students to keep in their head when they're working? Because you want to be referring back to these, just like Columbo's referring back to his different bits and pieces as he's going along. So yeah, I think you want a manageable number, and whatever that means to, you know, and I think the literature comes in, you know, around 8, you know. So I know that there's some I know that there's some guidance that says less for smaller bits of learning, and that does work. I do understand that, but I wouldn't be too prescriptive about it. I think the discerning factor is not necessarily the credit size; it's more about what's manageable for a student. What can they keep?
And I guess the diversity of what you're teaching, because I mean, if you're doing a 30 credit course on developing a metacognitive toolkit, then that's probably going to have like, you know, dozen 15 learning outcomes, because you're looking at developing sort of probably entry level for a lot of individual cognitive skills. Saying that, if you're doing a 120 credit course on the history of Brie, which is mostly just lots of people talking about Brie, realistically, you know, you've probably got one or two learning outcomes coming out of that.
Yeah, there is some, I think there's something in that. I just think, I think it's thinking about your student, really. You know, what can they manage? I mean, in the example I gave before, I just had one learning outcome for that 40 hours of work. I'm not sold on the idea that you really need to alter the amount very much, depending on the credit level. I think there probably is some complexity about the complexity of the subject, but you never want to be over 8 or 10. You never want to be more than that, because it's just not feasible for someone to keep those things in their head for that long, I don't think. If you're getting there, you want to be just abstracting them a bit further up and making them a little bit more.
Yeah, because you can always granulate them at an individual, like, you know, unit and chunk and block level.
100%, and that is exactly right. And whether you communicate it to the students or not, you know, is a decision for you as a teacher, I suppose. But
do communicate them to your students. I'm going to throw that in there. That's Mike's. I love the word transparent pedagogy. Since I read that paper years ago, it just made me so happy. I really like it. Conscious that we are just hitting time. So any final thoughts or tips, or shall I bring us to a close?
Two papers I want to highlight. Two resources that are really good. One is Jenny Moon's 2004 paper, Linking Levels, Learning Outcomes and Assessment Criteria. Brilliant stuff.
There'll be a link in the show notes.
Really straightforward, really easy to follow. Brilliant. And then there's another output by Declan Kennedy. He's from the University of Cork, and he's got a practical guide called Writing and Using Learning Outcomes, a Practical Guide, that is also excellent. It's got loads of good tips in there, really, really worth getting your hands on and using. And both of those things are products of the Bologna process. And very, very good. And the other, just one other thing I would say, always get hold of a checklist of some sort to check off when you're writing learning outcomes. And you want something to make sure that you've done what you're supposed to do. Get some kind of checklist. There's loads out there. There's one by Sarah Fulmer out there that's pretty good. I've got one that I've kind of developed myself because it's a bit more OU specific, so I use that one. That's worth having too. That's a good tool.
So we talked about good learning outcomes. What's a bad learning outcome look like?
Well, I've got a couple of examples that you might like.
Go on.
Okay. Here's one that's not very good. As a result of studying this course, you will learn what we can do to reduce our impact and the benefits and disadvantages of taking action.
I'm confused.
My
head.
Very complicated. Like, the sentence starter doesn't ring true. It doesn't link in with what it is.
I don't understand what it's saying.
There's benefits and disadvantages in the same sentence. They're not the same thing. They're not opposites of each other either. That's a bad one. I don't like that one at all. There's no verb. It's on many levels, it's not good.
Is that the worst one you've got?
No, I've got a worse one.
Oh, go on.
By the end of this course, you will have gained basic but vital information to help ensure you always work safely at X institution, whether you work on site, from home, in third party locations, or a hybrid of all. Not a learning outcome in any shape or form.
No. Also, it sounds like something that you might have drawn from our on site training.
X institution, Mike.
Okay.
Your words, not mine.
Anything else to add on the bad learning outcomes, or shall I draw the show up?
No, that's fine.
Okay, so Tom, thanks so much for joining me today in talking about learning outcomes and crime shows from decades gone by.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me. Listeners.
Do you have anything you want to plug? Where can people find you online, if indeed you want to be found?
No, I've stepped away from all social media after the Emerald Miner took the over the little bird site. So, yeah, I'm not on anything like that. I mean, I assume people maybe can contact you via the podcast.
Yeah, if you've got any questions for Tom, contact me if they're, you know.
You can forward them to me.
Yeah. Doctored.
but no, nothing really to plug. I mean, you can see my Google Scholar page if you want to have a look at that,
which will also be linked. There's a lot on there, a lot.
That'd be great. Yeah,
brilliant.
Well, thank you for having me. I think it's been great. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, cool. Well, and thank you very much to you, the listener. Thanks so very much for joining us. You can subscribe to us on all of your favorite apps, feeds, iTunes, and at our website, pedagogzilla.com. You can also follow and get in touch. You can get in touch with me via Twitter. I am at pedagogzilla. It's still called Twitter. I know it's got a different URL now and a different logo, but it's still called Twitter. And it will be called Twitter again in the fullness of time. We love you lots, and we'll see you next time on Pedagogzilla. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.